Good morning.
It's a delight to have you on. I've looked forward to having you on since we've read about your work.
I've also followed you with great admiration. Thank you.
Can you tell us a little about yourself, where you grew up, your background, what you've done?
Sure, thank you. My family came from Syria in the mid-60s. I was born in the U.S., grew up in Wisconsin, went to medical school on a Navy scholarship with the taxpayers' money, thankfully, and ended up doing my training at Bethesda Naval Hospital in Washington. Served on the USS El Paso as a chief medical officer for a year, part of Operation Restore Hope in 92, and came back, completed my training, served as chief resident at Bethesda. And since then, I joined my father here in practice in Phoenix. I'm an internist, primary care, and I also do nuclear cardiology. We formed our organization, the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, in 2003, not only fighting the tactic of terrorism, but actually fighting the ideology of Islamism or political Islam, which we believe is the primary malignancy that feeds the cancer of terrorism. And we've begun this process of creating a think tank here in Phoenix that has a membership that's slowly growing and beginning to get the intellectual word out of ideology, where we're able to separate religion and politics and Islam.
We are talking to Dr. Zudi Jasser, the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. You wrote an op-ed, Arizona Republic, about the situation in Minneapolis. Give us your perspective on it, please.
I was just flabbergasted that these imams, who really represent most of the so-called Islamic leadership locally, decided to, what I like to say, present themselves as politicians and not as spiritual leaders. They came off the flight, went right to the media cameras. Actually, one of them grabbed a media camera and wanted them to tape him yelling at the ticket counter lady because he was feeling discriminated against. And basically, in the op-ed, I said that, you know, as a Muslim, this is not the way to approach our civil rights. This is not the way to build bridges. It's the most anxiety-laden area in the world right now, is the airport and the gates.
Right.
And it's the front line in the war on terror. It is not a right to fly. It's a privilege. The airlines have a huge burden of especially the captain right before flight. He has to make some immediate, quick decisions as to whether the flight's safe. And he acted on some things. The imams claimed that this was about prayer. You know, people aren't used to and had that much contact with Muslims. And certainly it's important to get educated, but to intimidate people and push your faith in front of them and then demand equality is completely ignorant about and naive about how to build bridges. And actually, from an Islamic perspective and spiritual perspective, that's not the way to win friends.
I want to explore that with you further, but just in the facts of this case, as you very thoughtfully point out in your editorial, things were going on which would concern any prudent person. The guys asked for seatbelt extensions. They weren't big men. They were moving their seats around. They were speaking in Arabic. I mean, you kind of have to be foolish not to be a little concerned about this. Any reasonable person, Muslim or non-Muslim, would be.
Exactly. I mean, these guys are so out of touch. This is not about prayer. Nobody said anything before they went on the plane. All these kind of things put together in totality, you know, profiling is only affected by the civil right, our civil rights and the Bill of Rights and our First Amendment, when you are pulled off the street for no other reason other than randomly for immutable characteristics. But if you exhibit behaviors that are of concern, you get one-way tickets, etc. When my first name is Muhammad, which it is, and I get pulled aside, and it's because I happened to purchase a last-minute one-way ticket,
yeah,
I shouldn't have any problem with that.
Right. Well, believe me, my first name's Bill, and when I purchase a one-way ticket, I get the same treatment. Maybe a little longer because I have some kind of metal knee. So I'm in there a long time, you know. Are they or do they know exactly what they're doing, how to play the system, how to play the media, how to play the victim?
Yeah, you know, initially when I walked into this issue in 2002, we started to speak up. And I felt moderate Muslims needed to get a word and let America see what we stood for. I said, you know, one of the things I used to say was, well, the Muslim community is new. Over half of the Arab Muslims have only been here since 1980. They're still getting facile with American media and political activism, so give us a break a little bit. And, you know, now I can't say that anymore. I mean, these guys are slick. They know how to get attention. They know the issues that are hot-button issues on victimization. Every other week there's an issue. You know, they were 40 Muslims in Germany that were pulled off an airplane
right,
and delayed one flight, and they made a big deal out of it. And, you know, the issue here is they don't understand that our problem is not a PR problem. It's an ideological problem centrally, and it is also a credibility problem in that everybody sees that the Muslim community is not spending their money on fighting terrorism, on fighting the ideology, you know. And even from the airplane standpoint, I had family that went to Hajj last year, and they were delayed 4 days in Saudi Arabia because the Saudi royal family decided to put their own nationals on flights coming back to the U.S. Did CARE point that out? I wrote an op-ed about it.
4 days, you said.
4 days.
I mean, we just had top news story about people delayed for 3 hours because of snow.
Exactly.
And people were screaming at the top of their lungs.
That's the issue, is that, you know, this is like normal procedure in Saudi Arabia, is that Americans are second-class citizens to the Saudi nationals. And it's just, I called it flying while American on your way back from Saudi Arabia.
Okay. We're talking to Dr. Zudi Jasser, the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. Why the confusion? I mean, my audience says, and I believe it's a thoughtful audience, I think it's a tolerant and open-minded audience, but people say, why can't people who are here, who are American and Muslim, love the United States, why can't they step up and criticize, you know, not just terrorism, but as you say in your op-ed piece, criticize Al-Qaeda, criticize Wahhabi?
It's multifaceted. And
go ahead. You got time.
Okay. The first issue is denial. I think that, as you know, psychologically, when people are, you know, whether you have substance abuse problems or whatever it is, when you start to realize the first human instinct to respond to something is to deny it and say, well, it's not my fault. It must be foreign policy. It must be the conspiracy theories. And so that's a huge part of it. Secondly, I think, is the tribalism and corruption, in that, you know, many people have said because they use religion as their political weapon of unifying the Muslim community, then it must be the religion's fault. In fact, I submit that most of the Arab world is plagued by the lack of Islam, the lack of the humility and moral character of Judeo-Christian Islamic beliefs. And actually, they've gone to pre-Islamic tribalism, and we see that happening in Iraq. I mean, you see Muslims killing Muslims, and, you know, this is a corruption, a loss of the moral character that the God of Abraham gives us.
Can I interrupt you there for a second, and then you go back? A lot of people would pause here. We're going to talk to Robert Spencer later in the show and some others and say, no, look, if you look honestly and straightforwardly at the Quran is essentially, some people, critics would say, a loaded gun. It's about war. It's about domination. It's about conquest.
You know, I disagree with that wholeheartedly. Number one, strategically, militarily, if we say that, that takes away our strongest weapon against the jihadists, which is moderate Islam that will take away the theology and strip them of the mantle of religion that they're using. I wasn't created in a vacuum. I grew up in Wisconsin. I had the values from my grandfather, who was in prison in Syria years fighting this, and recommended to my dad to come to America. When my parents came off the airplane, they immediately were American nationals, feeling that they had more freedom to practice their faith here than anywhere in the world. Certainly, there are many passages. I know that Mr. Spencer quotes that, you know, recommendations on running society, but there's nothing preventing me, and this is how I was raised, from taking those passages and say that they applied to the leader of the faith at the time in 630 AD, and now they don't apply anymore. And now there's no longer any application of a religious leader also being a governmental leader.
Is there a silent majority in Islam that is more of your view than the Wahhabi view or the Al-Qaeda view?
The problem is I really believe it is a majority, because I've been...
How would we know? How would the rest of us know?
Simply by talking to every Muslim you meet. Ask them what they believe about political Islam. Ask them when their sermons in their mosques are political, and you hear the mixture of governmental policy with spirituality. Ask Muslims if they think that that's what should happen, if they think that imams and clerics should run government. You know, and the vast majority of Muslims I talk to don't agree with that. Certainly, they've abrogated the control of our faith to these individuals, but the problem is Muslims that do, you know, for example, my parents told me, you know, I want you to learn your faith from us. Certainly, the imam is an important source, but he's just a teacher.
Yeah.
Imam does not mean leader like these guys want to say it does. It actually means teacher. So the vast majority of Muslims do believe that it's separate. And the problem is we're trying to wake up a silent majority that doesn't want to politicize their faith, don't want to come to the media and the public through the vehicle of their faith. And that's one of the things these guys tell me, is that they'll say, Zudi, you're a hypocrite because you are getting attention and everything based on your faith. And I'll tell them, well, you know, I'll use your example, which was when you were head of the Department of Education, you ended up dissolving it. And that's exactly what my goal is to dissolve political Islam through my being a spokesperson for Muslims, one of them, and giving one other voice to say that, you know what, this is not the vehicle to politics. Leave the Sharia at home. This is how we can guide our families, but it should have no role in government, because there's no way a government driven by one religion could be pluralistic and be equal. And actually, I believe that my faith is abrogated when government coerces any values upon me through law.
Here's one theme I hear a lot. These are guys who work here in Washington, professionals. They say Muslims do not like to talk in public about it. They don't like to talk about their faith in public. They're not going to step up and say, no, I don't like Wahhabi, I don't like Al-Qaeda. But my objection to them when they've said that is, well, the other Muslims do, the Al-Qaeda Muslims do, the victims do, the imams at the airport do, Edmund Burke, all that needs to happen for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. I mean, don't people sort of have to come out of this tendency, maybe even admirable tendency, to mind their own business and start minding the business of Islam if it's to be reclaimed?
Absolutely. That's why I'm doing this. That's why I take time from my practice. That's why the solution to this problem is going to be Muslims that are business people, that do get their salaries and their paycheck not from religion but from their own businesses and from something else, because the currently employed religious community has a power structure to maintain, and they're going to do everything possible to prevent somebody else from taking back and reclaiming the mantle of faith. And we have to be vocal. I need to start to reach out, and hopefully we can build a network of what I call the unaffiliated Muslim. Only 30% of Muslims are mosque-going. And of those 30%, only 5% are actually active in political activist organizations. So I hope that America can see that these organizations that purport to be Islamic are actually, go to their websites, their homepages are all about politics, very little about the spiritual path to God that's a personal path. So it's a political lobby, it's a political movement that uses the name of Islam for their own agenda. And hopefully that 70 to 80% of the 4 to 5 million Muslims, I mean CARE, the Islamic Society of North America, MPAC, all these organizations, their membership roles are only a small percentage of the community. So yes, you're right. I'm doing this for my children. I want my children to be able to give their citizenship pledge and not have any conflict in their heart with their spiritual path at home, and know that, yes, I can practice Sharia and inheritance law and family issues, etc., but I do not take that into government. I only take the values of my faith into government, just as Jews, Christians, and everybody who is God-fearing does.
When non-Muslims get together and talk and shake their heads, one of the things they talk about is women and the treatment and role of women in Islam. Can you help us with this? Different divorce laws and punishments for adultery and so on.
Absolutely. The central tenet, I believe, and as my mom taught me and as my wife and I practice, is equality of men and women. Certainly that's part of what I believe is going to lead the Reformation part. There's a huge amount of what are practiced as laws supposedly of Islam but are simply barbaric, tribal, medieval laws like the Hudud laws, etc. These are not Islamic. These are tribal laws of Pakistani or Indian or Wahhabi nature. It's not related to the what I believe, and my mom and others have always taught me, is the liberation of women. I mean, actually, if you look at history, Islam provided women rights to property centuries before the West did. So there are nuggets in there of liberation of women. Now, is it an example right now for women's rights? Absolutely not. Okay. And that's why Muslims need to stop the denial and say that in order to gain credibility, we need to recognize that, you know, whether a woman wears a hijab or not is her choice, not her husband's choice. It's her choice. Inheritance laws need to be modernized so that they are equivalent to that of equality, etc. But these can be done through interpretation. It doesn't have to be done through saying that the Quranic text is faulty, because to me as a Muslim, I believe the Arabic text is authentic. Otherwise, my whole faith would start to fall apart.
I understand.
But what I can modernize is the interpretation into modern-day thought of 21st century and not 15th or 7th century.
Last question. You're criticizing some pretty powerful people. Are you afraid at all?
No. You know, first of all, I've not had any physical threats. Certainly verbal, I'm marginalized in my community, and I just continue to move forward saying that I'm doing this for my faith from a position of love. I do think it's important to always do this from a position of love of my faith, because when you start to criticize the faith, it's almost to me as if I'm criticizing God, because this is one of the faiths of God.
Yeah.
But I do not fear, because if I did, I always tell my friends that tell me, that support me and don't want to be public, I'll say, well, why don't we might as well go back to where my parents came from, to Syria, where there was no freedoms and everybody was quiet or got killed. I mean, America is about political discourse. It's about debate. It's about finding and seeking the truth and representing and being patriotic Americans.
I knew the answer to that question, Lieutenant Commander Jasser, Dr. Jasser. I knew the answer to that question. I knew you weren't. Thanks for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure.